McNamara's boss and Reese's boss. So they would be having these various development meetings for the Edsel. Mm-hmm. And Crusoe wanted a representative from each of the major divisions to attend these meetings, because if we were going to introduce a whole new line of cars, the Edsel, why, everybody would have something to do with them, you know. And I was appointed by McNamara to be the Ford division representative at the meetings. Mm-hmm. And so I duly got my notepad out and my briefcase and started over. And as I started to get in the car, he met me in the garage, I remember, and he said, "You go listen. You make no commitments about the Ford division to this." McNamara was telling me to this car. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Yes, sir, I understand." Mm-hmm. And he was dead right, too, because what he was concerned about is exactly what happened. They asked for contributions, in effect, market share. How much market share are the Ford division going to lose? How much is Lincoln Mercury going to lose? How much are we going to take from GM? How much are we going to take from Chrysler? And he didn't want anybody, McNamara didn't want anybody, preempting and having somebody come back and say, "Well, you agreed that you're going to give up X percent of," and we never did, as I recall, never did give up or state what percent of the market we would, give up. I guess the implication was sort of give up without a fight, I don't know. But Bob, the point of the whole thing was, Bob, I don't think ever believed in the Edsel and wanted to keep himself arm's length from it. And he was pretty successful in that.
Oddly, one of his old champions, Crusoe, did though, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
Had he been seduced by Reese's logic on this?
I think that between him and Judge and Reese, that they probably convinced Crusoe. I don't know, by the way, that Crusoe was all that much of a champion of of McNamara. Now, okay. I'm not implying that there was any hard feelings or dislike. No. I just never got the impression that Bob was being supported. His mentor was Crusoe. Could have been, it just didn't come through very clearly to me. Mm-hmm.
There was a certain amount of rivalry, I suspect.
Oh, although Crusoe generally had the advantage of being the senior, sort of elder statesman, you know.
Right. Intimate.
Yeah, that's right. And Mr. Crusoe had a way of I wouldn't want to say frightening people, but he kept them at their distance.
He was rather intimidating, though, wasn't he?
Yeah, he had a sense of humor, that showed through occasionally. One little incident, we were standing out in the courtyard one day with George Walker, and they had a model to show, you know. And George was a great politician. George always wanted to know which way the wind was blowing before he committed himself either way, you know. And Mr. Crusoe was late, and Mr. Crusoe had come out of the styling lobby doors and was walking the length of that courtyard out there, and we were all down under the one tree that existed at that time, and George was saying to one of the product planners, guys, said, "Which one does he like? Does he like that A model?" And the guy was insidious. He knew Crusoe didn't like it, so he told George he did. He said, "Yeah, he likes A, George." So when Crusoe comes up, Mr. George said, "Mr. Crusoe, this A model, you're dead right. That looks great. This really got the right line on to it, you know." And Crusoe looked at him. He says, "George, that car looks like it's been in an accident." just crushed on George.
McNamara rightly saw that the Edsel was going to be a disaster.
Well,
distanced himself.
Himself from it. Now, whether he did that because he saw it was a disaster or because he saw it as a threat to his division. You know, you can take your pick there.
Sure.
But generally, you know, hindsight's great. You know, we can all look back and say, now, yeah, Ezel was a fine car, no problem with it. It was as good a car as probably the GM counterparts, the Pontiac. It was just the wrong time. People weren't looking for that kind of a car.
Right.
And the theory being, Mr. Crusoe used to, Crusoe's support of the car was, you got to have as many stores as your competition has if you're going to sell as many suits. And we didn't have enough stores. We had Ford, Mercury, Lincoln, and he wanted to have a fourth store.
Yeah. We did have a big gap.
Yeah, he used to say, we are raising the customers for our competition. We take them up through the top grade of Ford, and then if they wanted to go up but didn't want to jump up to a Lincoln, they had to go to Pontiac or Olds or Buick or someplace like that.
Emmett Judge was an interesting character in this episode, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was gung-ho right up till the end.
Yeah, well, he was... he was the project manager, and that in a sense, he had been a product planning manager, and those two terms are almost simultaneous.
Yeah.
You know, they're almost the same words. And Emmett was the manager on it. Cute little story about Emmett in the Edsel that also involved George Walker. George had a tendency to fall asleep at a meeting sometime. This was a meeting of the design committee dealing with the Edsel, and they were dealing fairly early in the stage. They were dealing with the overall length of the car should be within limits.
Yes.
And they had developed a prop where they a cardboard prop where they could move the back wheels back and forth like this to indicate different lengths.
Oh yeah.
And Emmett was up doing this. George was seated up on the dais with Breech and with the rest of the committee, including Charlie Beecham. You know Charlie?
I've heard of him, yes.
Charlie was a comedian.
B-E-A-C-H-A-M,
Beecham.
And he was the sales
guy? Yeah, he was the old sales guy. And he loved to needle people, particularly George. And he was sitting next to George, and up sort of behind Breech, and Emmett was moving the car out, to see what length they liked, and George was nodding, and Breech said, "What do you think, George?" And Breech nudged George. He says, "How long do you think it ought to be, George?" And George says, "Right there, Mr. Breech, right." We claim that's how the Edsel got its wheelbase.
How did George Walker survive in that atmosphere of ridicule and
precariously. He used to pull some stuff. He was clever, and I can't go into all of the stuff he did because one time I. Bob McNamara called George and said, "George, I'd like to come over to the studio and this morning and take a look at that model we looked at last week and so forth." And George said, "Well, Bob, the boys haven't quite got it ready yet. Why don't you come, could you come about 2:00 this afternoon? I think we have it ready." And Bob says, "Okay." And he did. What he didn't know was that George's secretary had patched George through. George was in Miami.
Oh no.
George caught the airplane. Beard and all. Just barely made it.
Oh,
Bob never did know that he wasn't talking to him.
Incredible.
Oh yeah, there's just all kinds of stories like that. I was I remember my office at one point in time when I was in the Central Product Planning office was right across the hall, catty corner. Bill's Ford's office was there, but I worked for Bill.
Mm-hmm.
My office door was here, and Walker's was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going out one evening about 5:30, and George was standing in his office door, looking into his office, talking to his secretary. You know, he's standing like this, and I had a pretty good relationship with George, and I said, "Hey, George, what?" And he turned like that. He said, "What do you want?" You know, kidding. He had a pistol in his hand. He was joking.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But hell, this thing looks like a cannon. Yeah. They used to tell stories during George used to. George was would sit and watch his television with a gun on the floor. He was sort of, he wasn't a lot sure of himself. But whether that's true or not, I don't know.
Well, you moved into an interesting stratum here. There, someone has set up the Central Product Planning Office.
Crusoe.
And you're the first executive director?
Yeah, kind of. When it was set up, it was really Emmett Judge was the project officer for the EDSO, mm-hmm. and then of course went off to the EDSO division.
Right.
And Crusoe wanted to have a staff. Mm-hmm. That's what it was.
Yeah.
And so I was a product planning manager at the Ford division then. Don Peterson was product planning manager at the Lincoln division, I believe. Mm-hmm. McNamara had the Ford division, and Crusoe wanted to have a executive product planning manager, executive director, come in for this staff of his. Mm-hmm. So Bob McNamara called me down one day and said, "Crusoe, I'd like to have you come over and be the director." And later on, I got to be executive director. You know,
yeah.
They throw those terms around pretty loosely.
Right. Yeah.
And I said, "Well, what's it all about?" And he said, "Well, why don't you go over and talk to him?" So I did. And what Crusoe told me was, he said, "I want to have a staff here that's a small staff." And he said, "We've now got, I guess we then had, but then four divisions. We had Ford, Lincoln, Mercury, and Mercury and Lincoln, and Edsel." I guess we had four.
Right.
And he said, "I need a little staff to coordinate what these guys are doing." And he said, "Also to make sure they're bringing the stuff up to the management in some sort of an orderly, timely manner. And also to make sure that the vehicle divisions out here and the manufacturing divisions are getting along. We didn't have any more of this cowboy stuff, you know, and so on, all those good things. And I'd like to have you run it." And so I, by that time, I had matured a little bit, and I knew that you didn't argue really. I really didn't have a choice if I,
right.
I was going to go.
Mm-hmm.
I also had the feeling that Bob wanted to get Don into the product planning job in his division.
Mm-hmm.
See, Don had been with the company before I had.
Uh-huh.
And had gone off, been recalled to the Marines.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so
yeah,
he, 50s. Before I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob knew him then. I don't know exactly what job Don had in that initial, and it wasn't very long. But I kind of sensed that Bob would like to get Don into that job, and if he did, it'd have to be my job, because it would be a, you know, he couldn't put him
right.
A lower job.
Yeah.
So I went to become the director of the product planning office.
Mm-hmm.
Oddly enough, I never answered to Crusoe, although Crusoe then got his heart attack.
Oh, yeah.
But between the time that I took the job and the time I reported, or very shortly thereafter,
yeah.
He had a heart attack and never came back, of course. And so Bill Ford inherited Crusoe's job. So I had a long stint then in that job working for Bill Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And if you talk to Will came in for a while and worked for Bill Ford. And I worked for Will then.
Mm-hmm.
And then Will went off, I guess that's when he went off to be the safety director or something. Then I came back and ran it. So I was working for Bill. They put Will in there, cross, and he came up. And said, Will and I, I guess I count Will as probably my best friend in the company.
Uh-huh.
He and I always got along just great.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought he was a tremendous person, as I did Fred Sechrest. I think Fred just...
They came in together, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Yes.
And I hope Will told you some of their wild stories.
I'm sure.
He's really got some wild, but yeah. Both tremendous guys, and we try to keep in touch a little bit. Today, poor Will had such a problem with his wife, Barb, but that embolism, I guess.
Yes,
it is. Certainly, too, and she's a delightful person. Mm-hmm.
Well, you note that your responsibilities, however, as the executive director of the Central Product Planning Office, was pretty much as you had done as an executive assistant to McNamara, Crusoe, and then McNamara. Yeah,
it was still keeping what it was under McNamara. It took on a little bit different twist.
Uh-huh.
McNamara is a very creative guy.
Uh-huh.
And
tell us a bit about him in this role. Tell us a bit about him in this role. What his procedures were and how he thought.
Well, he was obviously very, he was brilliant. Mm-hmm. Two, he was intellectually egotistical. I think he almost had to be to go where he had gone. I think that he was very frustrated by the lack of drive and the lack of work and just the lack of people didn't measure up to his standards of what they should do. They didn't work as hard as he did or think as hard as he did and didn't drive as hard as he did. So he was he was that kind of a guy. He had a good perception of the job that had to be done in the company. And he moved into areas to get that job done that weren't really organizationally his responsibility. And I remember talking to him one time about it. I didn't forget what the particular thing was. I think it happened to come under Charlie Patterson at the time.
Who was
he was a vice president in manufacturing, probably engine something.
Yeah.
And I said, he was going to do this, or he told me to go do it. I said, Bob, you can't do that. It's not your bet. He says, I'm going to do it until somebody tells me to stop, which told you a lot about his character.
Uh-huh.
He was a very proud guy. I don't know whether he did this as sort of out of spite or whether it was really a fundamental characteristic, but he would make it a point to not use the company perks that went with his job. You know, if he was going to Europe on business or something, he didn't call up the travel agency and get first class and so forth. He had his secretary go call American Airlines and get a ticket, and he'd show up, and they wouldn't even know he was coming. You know, he'd show up at the airport and get a taxi and no car to meet him, and boy, he used to drive those guys crazy. You know, there was no way to get a handle on this guy, but it served a purpose. You know, he had a reputation of being a very lean, straightforward, no nonsense, no mixing of good times and business.
Mm-hmm.
One time, reportedly, they were going off on sales meeting or so forth, and whether he changed his mind or whether there was an inadvertent mistake, the people that were going showed up out of the company hangar with their wives.
Uh-huh.
Bob showed up and said, what are all the women doing? And they're not going home. Sent them all. You can imagine that setting up. But to get back to what kind of a businessman he was.
Yeah.
He was tended to be very objective. He tended to be, these are facts, and given these facts, you draw this conclusion, and drawing that conclusion, you move to this action. He, if anything, failed, in my opinion, to recognize human divergence or human error. And I thought about this many, many times after he went to the Pentagon, that he, that tendency to want to move only from a known base and so forth, and not being able somehow to discount what he was hearing and so forth, or even perhaps maybe caused him his greatest grief in the Pentagon. He was reluctant to, he was proud. Example, if you had an idea, and I had talked with him frequently, because when he got in that Crusoe job, I was his number one staff guy, you know, and he used my staff for the kind of studies he wanted and so forth.
Sure.
He really kept us busy, you know, Crusoe really didn't keep us all that busy,
yeah.
But Bob did. Bob Edison running on various and sundry studies. And you'd have an idea, you know, and you'd say, hey, Bob, what do you think about this? Or, you know, have you considered this and this? And he'd listen, almost impatiently would listen, and he said, well, I don't think that'd work. I think there's too many this or that. And you say, okay. A couple days later, you'd find that idea coming back around. But this time it was couched as, I'm thinking about doing this. And of course, you kept a straight face, because you, the point was you got your idea across, and you,
sure,
you weren't worried about getting credit for it. He had a little tendency to want to be the originator of ideas, and in that sense, he was egotistical. But he lacked a certain degree of imagination. One of the stories that I remember when I was there that really gave you a clue as to why he had a problem in the product area, particularly in the design area. We were over in the styling rotunda looking at a car, and George Walker was there, three or four of us. And Bob looked at the car and he says, George, that car does not give me a feeling of beauty. It doesn't give me a feeling like the, he was sort of searching, like the stained glass windows in the cathedrals of Europe gives me. George just looked at him, and some of us were back, looked at each other, and out of his earsight, says, Christ, those jigs down on them, they're going to go buy that car and don't even know how to spell a cathedral, much less worry about the windows. But the point was that he didn't have a feel for the, I guess, the common man, or what motivated people. And that, perhaps I'm too harsh with him, but all of the things that I saw him do, he was a very persistent guy, very thorough guy. And he would, and worked very hard, and a great deal. He and Phil Caldwell had a lot in common in that respect. Boy, they both worked hard at their homework. And
But they weren't very flexible. No,
they were not. Bob, though, the big difference was, Bob would make a decision when decision time came, and that wasn't always the case with Phil.
That's what I've heard. But it was an interesting time for you, obviously.
It
must have been very challenging.
Very interesting time, and then because you saw these people pumping through there, saw their styles, and I learned a great deal. I learned more in that period of time in that job than I certainly would have writing a doctorate on about any subject, because Bob went through there, and we had Bunky going through, Bunky Knudsen and his group, and then of course we had Lee coming on.
I guess at this point in the latter stages of McNamara's career, how did, up to about 1960, say, how did product planning coalesce as a company-wide process? You were at the very beginnings of it, pretty much, and were you able to influence the type of decision-making that went on in in terms of how the product was finally put together?
Yes, in an odd sort of a way. It developed during that period of time and became more used in a more generally accepted way of use later on with Iacocca. The vehicle divisions and vehicle division general managers were always trying to second guess or out guess Bob, you know, because Bob was really running the show. Breech and Ford were there, and Bob was the one that served up to them the alternatives, and it wasn't just a matter of saying, which would you like, gentlemen, A or B? It was, gentlemen, we have two here. A is the greatest, but if you guys in your stupidity want to take B, you want to go ahead. But, you know, it was a... So the vehicle divisions had to, in effect, sell Bob of what they wanted to do. And and the vehicle divisions, division managers were, you know, they were charging hard. They were being measured every 10 days by the sales, and the sales were a function of the product, and et cetera. But what my office became, and more me personally than maybe the office, was a switchboard of information. It was a two-way street. Bob used it, and Lee used to use it in spades. Mm-hmm. Bob would say, the Lincoln Mercury Division should propose going this way on in that field. I wish they'd think that through and come in with that, a proposal along those lines. I'd like to see how it'd work out. Mm-hmm. What he was really saying to me, go tell whoever it was, by that time Reith or Mills or whoever had it, McLaughlin maybe, go tell them that. I became a messenger back and forth. And it was a two-way street. The vehicle divisions, and there were some of the manufacturing divisions in there too, but mostly vehicle divisions, because that's what would say, we can't do that. We don't have enough manpower, or the budgets, or the program budget just won't make it. We've looked into that. I hope we don't have to kill ourselves running up at what will be a loose end. Mm-hmm. And what they were saying, see if you can get Bob switched off that. Mm-hmm. And it worked fairly well. Big bosses at the president, executive vice president level, don't frequently like, in general, you do this.
Yeah.
They don't like this straight. They like to have a sort of a slippery transmission of thought without having it to be, I am the boss, you listen.
Yeah.
And very frankly, the staff sort of served that purpose. Now, it wasn't always on a personal basis. It was, Bob would say, why don't you have your guys look at the advantages of a front-wheel drive in a car the size of the Falcon? It wasn't this, but sort of outline a study that we might consider doing. Well, then I'd go around the engineers and, you know, whoever I had to, the transmission people, the engine people, what's involved, pull together a sort of a well, here's what the job would be, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And they would know. They would know I wasn't dreaming that up myself.
Yeah.
And I'd tell them, you know, Bob was good. So what it did, and it wasn't a big staff at the time, you know, we had maybe half a dozen people, some of which were typists.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were product planners from the divisions. A lot of the product planners went back and forth through there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it served that, and with Iacocca, it was more pronounced. Lee didn't blow any money. He said, you go tell those bachelors I want them to do this, you know.
Yeah.
But that was a two-way street, too. I didn't have a license, a free license.
Yeah.
They expected me to help them get along with Lee within reason, you know, and to point out what's today's flashpoint or what's the flashpoint that's coming up.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it was very interesting and see the Lee was much better than McNamara, in my view. Mm-hmm. Maybe I just gotten older and got better ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But would be more acceptable to an idea. You know, you ask, hey, it's not a bad idea. Write that baby up. Let's see what you can do with that. Uh-huh. Let me take a look at it. Of course, Lee would chew your ass out too, like nobody's business if he felt like it. We all learned how to roll with that punch.
Yeah, right.
But it was an interesting time, and I always felt that I had probably the best job in the company for a long time,
yeah,
living through all those
certainly in the Catbird
in those periods, and acting as interpreter in some cases between and among the various and sundry executives that held those jobs.
I guess, what would you say to give us a sort of a case history of a product that you and Mr. McNamara obviously had a lot to do with it, the Falcon, and maybe that how to illustrate how Mr. McNamara thought about a certain type of product. Would that be possible?
Well, I don't know that I can give you too much in the way of specifics. I can give you some general concepts.
Mm-hmm. That'd be good. How it came about and who.
Yeah, Bob was of the opinion, as along with a lot of other people, that we needed a smaller car.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the GM car that preceded it was the Chevelle. Wasn't the Chevette yet? The Chevette came later. They had a smaller car. They, as I recall, they beat us. But I don't remember what it was. I can't remember the name of it. But in any event,
we're speaking of the GM small car.
Yeah, as I say, it might have been the Chevy too, but nevertheless, not important. The design of the car, if you'll recall, was, if anything, a very practical kind of a car, and that reflected the influence of Bob McNamara, I think, more than anybody else.
The Spartan outlook.
A Spartan outlook, and make it so that there's enough headroom in it, you know, mm-hmm. that you don't have to break your back getting into it, and that it rides high. You're sitting up. You got good visibility. It did not represent all that much of a challenge to the engineers or designers. I can't recall that we had any great weight control on the car. We may have. Yeah, I guess we did have too by that time, because weight got to be another factor in product planning, particularly as we moved on into the miles per gallon,
right.
Cafe considerations. So it had, I remember it had a weight factor, because it, at one time, one of the prototypes, they jacked it up and the bumper bent on it, where they put the jack under it. Reportedly, one designer said, I didn't design the bumper, I designed the underplace where you're supposed to put the jack and so forth. But it reflected, the designers were given to understand, now this is going to be a practical family car, small, but easy to get into, easy to handle.
Mm-hmm.
And the designs came out that way. It was not, as I recall, the most loved car in terms of the design people.
Who was responsible for the design of the Falcon? Do you remember of him?
Well, I guess at that point in time, I guess it would have had to have been Joe Orris.
Mm-hmm.
Who I think had the exterior studio, the Ford exterior studio.
Right, I think you're right.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. Joe had that, and at the time he had that, Gene Bourdonnais had the Lincoln Mercury studio.
Mm-hmm.
Walker, of course, was the vice president of design, mm-hmm. and Elwood was sort of a floater.
Swing man.
Yeah, he was. He did whatever George wanted him to do. You know, he might be working in interiors or
right.
special jobs or advanced jobs and
yeah.
so forth. But I'm afraid, other than that, it went through the normal kinds of development. Let's see, I believe the Falcon, if I'm correctly, was the first unitized car. And I think that we had a lot of the debate had to do with the merits of unitized versus body frame. Because our cars had been body frame up to that time, and that was sort of the, you know, the foundation of the car.
That was new for Ford, but was it new in the industry?
No, it was not new in the industry. Several European cars had had unitized construction. And I don't recall whether the Chevrolet car, that small car, had it or not. But I'm pretty sure Falcon was the first one. And I think so. Now, of course, practically all the cars have gone unitized.
So there's a lot of debate as to the pros and cons.
That's right. And but the as far as it was not a it was not a highly controversial car in the sense that anybody wanted to argue with McNamara, and rightly so, because we needed a small car. You know, the writing was on the wall, and it was.
He's certainly right in that respect.
Oh, he was. Yeah, he was. He was right in that. As opposed to the Mustang, was a creative bolt, as it were, you know.
Yeah, right.
And it had no counterpart.
No precedent.
And no precedent. Yeah. The Thunderbird, on the other hand, did have a counterpart, and that was the GM
Corvette.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I remember the day that was born. Bob McGuire was the guy that was started on the Thunderbird. And he was told to make a car that was better than the Corvette and cheaper, and was made with steel, not with fiberglass. And we went down in his office, and he started, sketching. And then you'd end up with hundreds of sketches and put them on the wall, and they'd look around, walk around and look at them and pick out a few. The process, did Gail take you through the process of selecting design?
Somewhat, but and, go ahead.
Yeah, well, it was just a, just an impressive thing of how they had quite a few young designers out there, and they had these boards, and they would sketch, and the bosses would come down, and that's pretty good, develop that one a little bit further. And then they'd end up on a wall, you know, as a sort of a starting point, and the management would walk through maybe say, what do you think about that one? Well, let's take that another step. And it was an elimination process, because sketching was cheap. When you got to full-sized renderings, you know, full-sized car, that took some time and obviously money. And then when you went from that to clay, that's when you really got into the dough and did a clay model. And then when you went to see-through, where you could see through the greenhouse, and each one of these build up, and running a design studio is not the cheapest thing in the world to run.
Imagine, yeah.
I often thought we played around at various times in the design center and never could convince anybody, and probably correctly so, at how much money you could save if you could somehow design a miniature model. In other words, like a toy car. And then if you could put the viewer in some kind of a machine or something, a box that he was looking through, where it appeared to him to be full size, where he had no reference points, and whether we couldn't save a ton of money, and nobody agreed with him. They were probably right. The styling, we used to spend a tremendous amount of money, and I'm sure they still do, on styling clinics. We take these cars out and do various, we used to laugh about it. We'd get the Toledo housewives up here, and they'd bring a couple busloads of people up from Toledo because it was close, and take them over here and show them a number of models, and then give them lunch, you know, and take them back. And Mr. Ford never really thought that was such a brilliant idea. As a matter of fact, he used to chide the stylists. He'd say, you guys just can't make up your mind, so you want to blame it on the Toledo housewives, you know. Yeah. He never really quite bought it all the way.
There's a trenchant kind of point there, in the sense that even today, the reliance on what is known now as consumer research was really kind of scary.
Yeah. Now, the theory, the biggest theory, or the biggest drawback that people ascribed to it was one, people didn't know what they would want 3 to 4 to 5 years down the road. And secondly, if you had something, if one of the alternatives they were viewing was somewhat similar to what was on the road today, that tended to get a leg up. Mm-hmm. People tended to like more what they were familiar with. And I think that there are definite limitations. And we used to, you know, you'd show them the car. Well, which car do you like best? And A, B, C, and D. And so they'd select the car. And then they say, okay, now, what do you like about the car? What about the grill? And then the guy said, oh, grill, I forgot it had a grill. Then he had to think up something to say about the grill.
Yeah.
And there was always a problem of, were they trying to please you or not, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we used to spend a lot of dough on those things, carting them around the country. And they'd take them to California because California was supposed to be the avant-garde. You know, if the Californians liked them today, they'd be great 5 years from now.
Yeah. You were never too sure of that particular precept.
No, we never particularly sure of that.
I remember the Edsel relied very, very heavily on bringing a gentleman in, Dave Wallace, who went through a lot of academic survey research motion and came up with what he thought the Edsel would appeal to, and nothing came of it really.
Yeah, well, it's what we know about subjectivity particularly in the aesthetics field is, even to get people to admit that styling or appearance is an important buying characteristic,
right,
is you ask people, you know, you take a bunch of people into a meeting and say, all right, now we're going to list here a bunch of characteristics, and you tell me which are the most important to you, mm-hmm, when you buy a car. Safety, durability, mileage, reliability, reputation of the dealer, reputation of the company, family-owned one, you know, a whole factor of them.
Right.
And you'll get what appear to be a very supportable rationale. You know, safety will be high, price will be high, and so forth. If you put appearance on there, or style, it'll tend to be low.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, we knew from other research that that wasn't true. So we started changing the question. You'd take the people in and you'd say, what do you believe motivates your neighbor to buy a car? And styling would come up very near to the top. It was all right. It was, he's a flighty kind of a guy. He doesn't have good basic values. You know, he's style, whatever looks good. He's not really concerned about what's important. You know, I'm smart, I know what's important. Kind of, you know, you always were playing in that field.
Yeah.
And they developed some rather, I guess, what they considered sophisticated techniques for the way they ask questions, mm-hmm, and so forth.
That's right. Yeah. That was an imperfect science at best.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And I suspect people in your discipline looked at it somewhat askance at it.
Well, you did, but being human beings, what you did, you know, if the styling agreed with us, it's like the lawyer says, you know. If the law's on your side, pound the law. If the facts are on your side, pound the facts. If neither are on your side, pound the table.
Yeah.
Well, if the styling was on our side, that styling research, boy, that's good, boy. Well, what do you expect the Toledo Housewives, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, the Falcon was very Spartan in the car, but it did have a measure of success.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, that was the right car, right time. Uh-huh. Just like the Edsel was the wrong car at the wrong time.
A complete antithesis, I think.
That's right. Answer. Almost a, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, the Falcon was, I guess, until the Mustang came along, the highest sales car in the history of the company.
So in a sense, McNamara felt vindicated that his vision was the right one.
Yeah. We always felt that it was too bad that for the company that Bob left when he did. If you could have if we could have today, of course they both age some, if we could have a Bob McNamara as a chairman and a Lee Iacocca as a president, what a tremendous team. If we'd have had those for the last 10 years, what a tremendous team it would have been.
You're so right.
because they complemented each other. Bob right. had a good business sense, you know, and he had a he wasn't type to get carried away. Lee tends to be quite emotional. You know? Mm-hmm. Lee will really get himself worked up, and we always said that Lee sort of had to have somebody as a sort of a flywheel, a counterbalance to keep him at least both feet on the ground most of the time.
There's a poignant story. I wonder if you've ever heard it that I read. David Halberstam recounts it in his Best and the Brightest. That after McNamara had been at the Department of Defense for a couple of years, and back in Dearborn, someone began tinkering with his favorite car, the Falcon, and he found out they were considering a convertible. And he writes back to one of his confreres rather plaintively, "What the hell are you doing with my automobile?" Do you remember anything about
that? I can't confirm that. I don't know whether that happened or not.
but they did begin to tinker with it, as they did the Thunderbird, and it became a far different automobile.
And the Thunderbird, it has gone through so many gyrations. It's gotten big, and then it got little again, then it got big, and it got Bunky put four doors on it, you know, and about the only thing that's really survived is its name.
But the sales were, I think, indicative of the two-door, the two-seater, I should say, the two-seater Thunderbird sales were, the press was very good, the sales were not too exciting.
That's
and
right.
I think, do you remember who made the decision to make it a four-place car?
No, I don't don't remember that.
But whoever did, it was a good decision.
It was a compromised four-seated car. It was at least, lifestyle of people that buy that kind of car. There tend to be more country club people that want to take another couple to the club rather
right.
than
yeah.
a single hotshot that just. And that was sort of where it was coming from. Yeah.
Those early '60s Thunderbirds were really very, very well done.
Oh, yeah.
Stylistically and mechanically.
Yeah. I have always been of the opinion that, at least over the years that I was with Ford, the most important single element of Ford's success, to the degree that it had success, that is, of its maintaining rather consistently for a number of years its second place position, was its styling difference.
Mm-hmm.
If you were a reasonable man, a reasonable buyer, and stood back and said, "I want to buy a car. What car should I buy?" You would, based on just objective criteria, probably most people would come to a Chevrolet or a GM car. As a matter of fact, they'd come to a Chevrolet, a cheap Chevrolet.
Mm-hmm.
Basic transportation, most dealers, most service points, better reliability history than Ford. It had everything going for it. It was always priced competitively and frequently mm-hmm. below Ford. Why would anybody buy a Ford?
Mm-hmm.
Well, enough people bought a Ford, and I can think of only one reason: the design of it. Now, a certain number would buy because there was a dealer in town, you know, and Dad knew the dealer.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, as far as the product goes, the fact that Ford offered a different design, true, it was Chrysler offered a different design too, but theirs was so terrible.
Yeah.
They're really ugly cars. And Ford, regardless of the criticism that the design center would come in for, and they'd come in for rather regularly, you know, the car wasn't on the goddamn design, you know. But they were the ones that had enough difference in Ford design that gave the customer a choice, and there were enough people looking for a choice.
Mm-hmm.
That's simple.
Well, McNamara is spirited away by the Kennedy administration. Did that cause quite a bit of consternation in the product planning group, or the group that you headed?
Well, we were all surprised. We finally got used to surprises.
Yes.
McNamara's I forget which one occurred first, but Henry Ford's divorce, first divorce, was cataclysmic. You know, we thought the company would fall in the next day because Ford, to a much greater degree than probably any other company in the world, was more personalized with Henry Ford than, hell, nobody knew who had a GM, you know, outside of Detroit. Mm-hmm. We thought surely that we'd just never see the light of day again.
You lost the you lost everything but the young vote.
That's right. And then Bob's leaving was a surprise to us, although we had a little warning. We knew he was being courted for Treasury, you know, a day or so forth.
Right. Yeah.
Did it bother us, particularly those of us in the product area? No, not really. Mm-hmm. Not nearly as much as Iacocca's leaving.
Yeah, right.
Or as Knudsen's coming in.
Oh, yeah.
That really, Knudsen's coming in really stood us on our ear. Mm-hmm. And Iacocca's leaving really left a tremendous gap among a number of us. And that number, I gotta say, was the Iacocca camp.
You're right.
There were a couple of camps there, and when Henry fired Lee, we felt the bottom really fell out. When Bunky came in, when Henry brought Bunky in, we weren't all that shattered because after the first shock wave went through, you know, most of us could figure out pretty well where it was going to end up. Because we knew of the, we knew a little bit about Knudsen from what we heard, and we certainly knew how Iacocca would deal with that, and he dealt with it just exactly like we thought he would. He stonewalled him.
Well, you, after McNamara's departure, who did you report to at that time?
Well, and I guess was that when the elderly gentleman came in, it was a manufacturing guy.
Dykstra?
Did Dykstra follow?
I think so.
I think John may have followed.
For a couple of years. I think it was sort of an honorary.
Let's see.
A reward for services rendered.
Where was RJ in that?
He was controller after McNamara left, or had moved up, and I think he was still in the finance area. Wasn't he?
Well, he might have been. RJ got moved out for Knudsen. That's
moved aside. Yeah.
Yeah, moved aside.
Yeah.
So it must have been Dykstra that
came in.
I think so.
Yeah, in the 70 to 72 or three or something like about 2-3 years. Yeah.
Probably in there. And John was a nice gentleman. did not. Consider himself a product oriented kind of a guy, and it didn't make too many ripples in the water, really.
But was there one problem there, as I recall, Mr. Mr. Scott saying something about a decision that Mr. Dykstra made in terms of product planning? He was engineering oriented, and he felt that's where product planning should go. Was that
well? That may have. He's true. He was engineering oriented.
Yeah.
And there was a point in time. Now it may have been at Dykstra's when Dykstra was there. Mm-hmm. Both Dykstra and Charlie Patterson were anti product planning. And pro. Either engineering or manufacturing.
The old line opposition that you had to put up.
Yeah, and it's entirely possible that that the movement did start to go then to really follow GM, because GM historically, and I guess they still have, pretty much had the product planning under the engineers.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And we eventually, the organization, I can't tell just when this happened, product planning disappeared as a word, mm-hmm. and product development became the word.
A more all-encompassing
word. Right, and it was, I guess, the first head of product development was Don Fry.
Uh-huh.
And Don, of course, was an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
So that may have occurred about in that time.
Did it make much of a difference in terms of your processes of planning?
I was off of the staff at that time.
That's right. You had gone out.
I'd gotten out of the line operation.
Yeah.
And I can't recall that it made any particular impression.
Mm-hmm.
We used to kind of joke about Dykstra, you know. Dykstra was sort of there were a couple stories that, one, I wonder if Will told you about, they were arguing some pricing. Will was making an argument about pricing a vehicle here, you know, and
mm-hmm.
Dykstra was in the room, and somebody said, well, why are you pricing it at that level? And Will said, well, you know, Adam Smith says supply and demand and so forth and so on. And after the meeting was over, Dykstra clearly didn't agree with him. He got a hold of Will, and he says, Will, I don't agree with you, and I want you to get that guy Adam Smith out of your office into my office tomorrow, because I want to talk to him. And Will didn't, you know, didn't know what to say. Some of us heard it. And Dykstra walked off, and Will's always a wit, you know. Somebody said, Will, what are you going to do now? I'm going to find, hire a guy that's called Adam Smith. But, he was not a, as I recall, an influence. And it may be that the engineers started to move in then.
Yeah.
Fry was more of a product planner than he was an engineer,
yeah,
really.
That's good. Yeah.
And we really didn't have a major conflict there.
At this point, you have quite a different assignment. How did that come about? You're moving into the international area.
Yeah, 72. That came about because in the course of the staff job, a guy by the name of Ed Molina. Did you know Ed?
No.
No, Ed came to
Molina.
Uh-huh. Came to the company from New York, from the futures trading business.
Oh, uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, he and John Andrews, you know, the fellow that went to be first head of Ford of Europe.
Oh, yeah.
John came first, and he brought Molina. Molina is a whole story in himself. Very unique kind of a guy. Last of the entrepreneurs. He's the one guy in the company, I always said, that worried about the company's money as though it were his own.
Mm-hmm.
A crude, rough, knowledgeable, streetwise kind of a guy that certainly didn't fit the Ford committee image kind of thing at all.
Yeah, that's right.
And he came in, I guess at this time, Tom Lilly was head of international. That was when they had the international here, before Ford of Europe.
Yes.
And Ed was put in charge of Mexico, I guess. His first job was managing director of Mexico. And he, his heritage was, he spoke Portuguese and Spanish, and I think maybe he was from Paraguay or Uruguay, his folks were or something.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, he had South America, and they made him, after Mexico, they promoted him to to vice president of South America, Ford South America. And he collected up a little staff. Matter of fact, Bob Alexander went to work for him for a while. Gene Carr was there for a while. I was there, Tom Denemy, a couple of other guys, maybe a half a dozen guys.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the international staff, which tried to really act as liaison. Ed, because he came in the company late, And because he really never spent a lot of time in the U.S., didn't have a very good feel for really for how the U.S. system worked. Mm. And so he had me and the staff to be, you know, Ed, what do you want to do? We'll get the U.S. people lined up to do it and for you to meet with them. We sort of acted as his representatives in the U.S. company. Sort of was sort of an outsider in some respects, you know. Henry Ford liked him. He liked it. Ed had a sense of humor. He'd take young guys. At that time, I was a young guy, and he'd take these young guys and. He could drink them right under the table. Energy, that guy, we'd get in an airplane and we'd fly to Rio or Sao Paulo or someplace down there. And we'd immediately upon landing, we'd start a meeting. We'd meet all day. That was left of it all afternoon. It seemed like all night, 11 or 12 o'clock. And then, geez, come on, let's go.
You had to have a rather large capacity for alcohol.
You had to have a cast iron stomach to work for that guy. Yeah. He was something else. Mm-hmm. Women, oh Jesus, he would surround himself. he wouldn't think of two guys that were as far apart as you could get. Think of Ed Molina and Phil Caldwell. were just about as far as you could get. But Ed had. His strength was, he understood the South Americans. Uh-huh. He understood the government. Right. He understood what made them tick. He understood their greed and understood how to use them. Mm-hmm. And he wrote pretty much on his own the automotive decree that runs, under which Mexico is operating today.
Really?
Did the same thing in Brazil and in Argentina. Uh-huh. Ed had a big hand in that. Mm-hmm. And he knew the politicians. He'd say, I've run up four bills and whorehouses in South America. But he said, that's the way the Mexicans think.
Yeah.
And you know, mm-hmm. And he did make a lot of money for the company. He made, he worked out this thing where we could import into Brazil engines that we could sell at a tremendous profit. Because they didn't make engines there. Yeah. But we had to export something, you know, the so-called 3-for-1. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot under Ed. I worked for him, I guess, about a year and a half. Uh-huh. I used to enjoy him. He was just tell jokes. He could just tell jokes, just one right after the other. Unfortunately, Ed would smoke cigarettes faster than that. And He contracted cancer and died here 3-4 years ago, I guess. But what a character. He used to say, I don't care what they do to me. They can never take the dances away from me that I dance. They eventually, at one point in time, then they gave him both South America and Southeast Asia. He had the whole works.
Yeah.
And then when they cut that back, Iacocca was concerned that Ed would leave. They didn't want Ed to leave. Ed was a power.
Sure.
In those areas, the dealers loved him.
Yeah.
He talked about having a dealer meeting, your hotel, and have the dealers in for dinner and so forth. Ed would go up into the mountains in the country and have a dealer meeting in an army barracks, mm-hmm. get them all up there, then bring about 3 or 4 truckloads of women up, mm-hmm. and just put the gates down on the women. Stuff like that. But.